This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello and welcome to the National Museum of Australia here in the nation's capital, Canberra. And welcome to our event today, which is Wi-Fi, Wires and the Ways to the Future. My name is Robert Bunsley. I look after digital outreach programs here at the museum. First of all, I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and pay respects to their elders, both past and present, and to their future leaders coming through. I'd like to welcome our on-site audience here in the Visions Theatre of the National Museum of Australia to this last event in our History of the World in 100 Objects lecture series. We've had a number of amazing panel discussions and lectures and conversations over the last couple of months that have looked at a whole range of the themes that are encapsulated in our current blockbuster exhibition. I'd like to also welcome our audiences off-site at the Kiama Library on the coast of New South Wales, and also our audience at the Adelaide City Library, where they are watching our internet stream. At some stage, they may have some questions, and hopefully they will be able to email those through, and we may be able to feed some of those questions into our discussion. I'd also like to welcome perhaps our other internet, unknown internet audience who are watching that stream. So now I'd like to introduce our very special guests this afternoon for this conversation. So may I introduce Dr. Terry Percival. Terry has more than 30 years' experience in delivering ICT research outcomes, specialising in radio communications and applications for high-speed networks. Previously, he was a laboratory director of NICTA and the chief research scientist at CSIRO's telecommunications division. While working at NICTA, he guided the creation of 10 successful spin-out companies and the transfer of research outcomes into government and industry. As co-inventor of technologies for wireless communications, he led the creation and patenting of technologies that underpin Wi-Fi. And as a result, more than $500 million in royalties has flowed to CSIRO. He's received numerous national and international awards, including the CSIRO Chairman's Medal and the European Inventors Award, and he was made a member of the Order of Australia in 2014. And may I also welcome Dr. John O'Sullivan. John has had an extensive career in wireless, signal processing and radio physics in both research and commercial contexts. He worked with the Netherlands Foundation for Radio Astronomy, leading the engineering team for the Westerbork telescope. At CSIRO, he led a research group in signal processing and later in wireless communications, which resulted in key technologies underpinning Wi-Fi, used in 15 billion devices worldwide. We just got the updated number on that. He led a team which developed a single-chip fast Fourier transform processor, which has found applications in military surveillance and astronomical applications. He returned to radio astronomy with CSIRO on the Australian Pathfinder, or ASCAP, project for the International Square Kilometre Array Radio Telescope. He is a winner of the Prime Minister's Prize for Science, the European Inventors Award, two CSIRO Chairman's Medals, and the 1992 CSIRO Medal for the development of fast Fourier transform technology. So welcome, gentlemen. Those are extremely impressive CVs, and it's wonderful to have you here at the National Museum for this conversation on the development of Wi-Fi, but also later on touching on where you see technology and Wi-Fi leading us into the future. So, our current exhibition, A History of the World in 100 Objects, from the British Museum. And this exhibition is open until the end of January, so if you haven't seen it yet, make sure you get along before then. For this exhibition, the National Museum chose your prototype equipment to be the 101st object in the exhibition. This is the National Museum's contribution to the exhibition, and your equipment is part of the National Historical Collection. I was just wondering, maybe you might reflect on how you felt when you heard that your prototype equipment was selected as one of these key cultural objects in the history of humanity.
Yeah, I think I was a bit shocked when I got when we got the phone call, the message they wanted to put it on display. And then I looked at the 100 objects that were already there, and I did realise that one of the interesting objects in the interesting choice is a credit card. It's very boring to display a credit card in a museum because we've all got them, but that's because we've all got them in our pocket.
Yeah.
And it turns out the other thing we've all got in our pocket is Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And so I suddenly said, oh yeah, no, it's not a silly idea at all. It is something that's changed the way.
It's transformative.
Yeah.
There's probably 100 devices in this room right now.
All competing with each other.
Yes. Giving our Wi-Fi a bit of a beating. Yeah, and John?
Well, I guess an honour, and a particular honour when you see the sorts of objects that precede us there, and sort of always mindful of the fact that I at least, am continually surprised at how smart people were in ancient times.
Yeah.
And there's some staggering things.
The quality of some of the craftsmanship on those artworks from the time that they were is really incredible, isn't it?
The time spent on them.
Mm.
Maybe that's something we can't do anymore. We don't have time.
No.
And this because of things like Wi-Fi.
Because we're all looking at our phones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you two are credited as co-inventors of Wi-Fi. And I'm just wondering if you might be able to take us through how this project started and how you two came together, or were you working in separate teams and working in parallel? Just give us a bit of a brief overview of those early days.
Yeah. Well, I'll jump in. It's all John's fault, of course. We actually did our PhDs at the same university on the same radio telescope project, although John had left by the time I started. And then we came together.
Personal.
Yeah. And then we met up at the CSIRO when the CSIRO was building the Australia Telescope at Narrabri. And I then went off and worked somewhere else. And I got a phone call from John in 1991, I'll never forget. I was painting my living room. I took a week off to paint the living room, and I got this phone call, do you want to come to lunch? I said, oh yeah, better than painting. So I went out and had lunch with John and some of the other friends. And he said, I've got this exciting new project coming up. And he said, we're going to build the world's fastest wireless LAN. And my first question was, what's a wireless LAN and why would you want one? And so back at the office, John showed me his laptop. He had a laptop. And I'd never seen a laptop before.
'91.
I think I'm vaguely aware of it, but I'd never actually used one or anything. And John had one, and maybe John, you want to say where you, the frustrations you had with it. I think you.
I think it goes back to around about 1990, a couple of years before that even. I was challenged by my boss at the time, Dr. Bob Frater. We need to make an impact.
Mm.
Would like you, speaking to some of us, to turn your skills built up in radio astronomy to more commercially oriented research, and we need to make an impact, to use Bob's favourite term.
So turning that blue sky research into applications.
Exactly. And now, at that time, as Terry points out, laptops were starting to make their presence felt in business environments. access to the computer, to take notes, things like that. But in a research environment in particular, something called networks was beginning to make an impact. And a network at the time was a pretty clumsy thing. It was a cable about a centimetre in diameter that had to run all the way through the building, and you would actually physically tap into it with a little screw attachment. And that was the way you would connect to this Ethernet. So to cut a long story short, we started to think, well, what if wireless networks existed? They were slow. But we started to think, what if you could do a wireless network that ran at the same speed as the best wired networks? Mm-hmm. Then you could have all these advantages of the networks, access to big lots of data, email, stuff like that. Before the World Wide Web, though, before browsers.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a bit of a leap of faith, and then, you know, everybody that came on board and bought into it. And
yeah. And, I mean, you were proposing 100 megabits per second speed as something that might be achievable, which is pretty incredible, given that... that even today, as we wiring up the NBN, you know, we're sort of looking at wired connections that are maybe 25, 30 megabits per second. So you were really thinking big.
Yeah, and we had various ideas of how this might be used. We saw things like video, training videos, somebody working, a mechanic working in the bowels of an aircraft, where... people in lecture theatres being able to access information about the lecture. But I think, you know, like so many of these things, you only see a piece of the... so many inventions were based on work-type usage.
Mm.
But within the shortest possible time, it turns out the killer app is, in fact, entertainment.
Yeah.
What we see now is social networks. Is
build it and they will come.
Yeah.
Yeah. I heard an anecdote that you... Well, not an anecdote, but I heard that you, prior to that, you'd been working on trying to find exploding black holes. And I'm wondering if that sort of led to some of that work led to the way you were thinking.
Certainly, in a way. And there are a number of things. I think all of us in the team, and this was a team, we couldn't, no one of us could have done it on our own, I believe.
No.
That was an important aspect. But and the reason the team was a good team was because we'd all cut our teeth working on different challenging problems.
Yep.
One of them for me was a failed experiment, in fact a series of failed experiments that got ever more complex technology, looking for exploding mini black holes. These are sort of microscopic black holes that Stephen Hawking proposed might be left over from the original Big Bang.
Well, that blows your mind, doesn't it?
Yeah. Mm. And if you were near one of these things when it went off, it would literally blow your mind. And we thought maybe if they are there, and Stephen Hawking was suggesting that they would... the smaller the black hole, the faster it would radiate energy and it would maybe explode.
Mm.
And Martin Rees, another astronomer, Lord Rees of Ludlow, the astronomer royal in the UK, he suggested that it would be like an electromagnetic pulse. You might actually be able to see this over astronomical distances. So we set out to try
Went to try and find it. And, Terry, I was watching an episode of Catalyst about this, and I took particular note because I heard you talking about these early days, and you had a little comment about the Star Trek communicators, and it made me think, how some of these popular culture shows, science fiction shows, sometimes actually lead the way, predict the way to the future, and they get people who are at that stage of development to think about applications that maybe they wouldn't have thought about.
Yeah, I think that's true, that science fiction writers are an interesting source of imagination and technology prediction. I think it was interesting, someone pointed out that in Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, one of the astronauts actually was using something that looks remarkably like an iPad. Mm. And that film was, 1971 or something like that. So there are those predictions out there if you look at it. So you've got to use that sort of imagination. Mm. And the Star Trek communicator obviously is what we've got in our pockets today.
Yeah, it looks just like our phone, really.
Yeah.
Only not as powerful as our phones.
That's right. Yeah, they do. Our phones do a lot more now.
Yeah. So maybe you could just tell us, this is a rather broad question, but what was it that your team did that was so great? I believe there were 20, 22 different research teams around the world working towards some sort of wireless solution to these sort of networking problems. How was it that your team beat them all to the gun?
I think we've probably both got a take on this.
I think we. And if these pictures that are flashing up behind us show the various stages of progression we went through, mm-hmm. in the thinking from the original ideas that we come up with paper and whiteboards. People still use whiteboards, which is good.
Yeah.
Not blackboards, but we did that, and I think the fact that we target was 100 megabits per second, or in fact, the device that's on display in the museum now actually will run at 150 megabits per second. So we really wanted to push it. Mm. And we weren't afraid of pushing the frontiers of technology and using the skills that we developed in the various radio astronomy projects. We knew we could build complicated devices. And I think the other 22 teams, there's actually been a significant study done on the other 22 teams around the world as part of our legal proceedings that we've gone through, which we'll come to later. And they showed they were all trying to get just, 10 megabits per second or 20, and they were struggling to get that far. And they were building on existing sort of networks and just doing incremental changes, whereas John, we said just scrap all that and try and find something that's really going to go fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd second that. I think the 100 megabits per second was, maybe I'd like to call it inspired, but it might have been
foolish,
lucky or foolish choice, because that was the thing that meant we couldn't rest on our laurels. We had to come up with something quite new.
Yeah.
And it's all about reverberation.
Yes, I was going to ask you.
Radio reverberation. Mm. And once you get beyond a megabit or something like that, you really have to do something to solve that. And I think with this small team, with diverse skills ranging from maths to physics to engineering, software... we sort of argued with each other in rooms and in front of whiteboards and in corridors. And
there must have been some real spaghetti on those whiteboards.
Yeah, but gradually you'd say, oh, wait a minute, somebody would say, what if we did this? And and that would provide part of the solution, and then that would uncover the next set of problems. And
what were the key problems to overcome?
I'm not sure there's, from my perspective, one of the important ones was the idea that if you try to send the bits one after another, then you run into this reverberation problem full on. So the first step was, what if we split the bits and send them together but on different tones? And then one of us realised that actually we had the technology to do that. It's what a Fourier transform did. Mm-hmm. And there was a sequence of steps like that. And Terry, you probably see a different set of things. But
yeah, I think that was one of the things, the reverberation in the room, and the fact that you wanted to go 100 megabits means you had to do something totally different. we had to apply error correction. There's also the classic fading problem that you get with your mobile phone. But, you know, sometimes you walk around the corner, it doesn't work. And we had to overcome those sort of problems because that was part of it. I think, you know, the solution we came up with in the end, which is on display downstairs, is now actually starting to form the basis of 4G and 5G networks. So the solution we come up with is now sort of scaled. It's the only way to make wireless networks go fast. And I think if you look at, in the team here, the photos that are coming through, we started out with the first prototype, which is these boxes this big, and then we weren't believed. We went around the world. John went and I and John separately and I separately went around the world to various large computer companies, which we better not name, and you know, they said to us, nah, no one wants to go 100 megabits. One person even who was actually on our side said, oh, 2 megabits is the most you'll ever get out of the back of a laptop. Another person said, wireless is a passing fad. That's just one of those new fads. So.
Yeah. But in fairness, we did come across one researcher in IBM Research. Yes. Eyes as big as saucers as soon as we talked about
If you
about
see,
this.
One of the photos here is actually us meeting with him. Yeah. The photo of it, it's obviously the oldest photo in there because of the clothes John and I are wearing. It's got the names on it. That was a meeting at IBM's research lab at TJ Watson. I think John gave the story, scared me with it. He went there first. He said he walked in the corridor and there on the board are photographs of all their Nobel Prize winners.
Yes.
And
this is as you drive up and there's this building covering the entire mountainside.
That was IBM research. But they loved what
bigger than they had a budget cut bigger than the entire CSIRO budget.
Yeah. It must have been a bit intimidating, I suspect.
It was, but he was a champion and he helped us. But IBM decided to get out of the networking game, basically, and you know, they got out of a laptop game in the end.
Yeah.
So that didn't go anywhere. But that was ironic. But the one person who wanted to work with us was for the company that decided to
pull out.
Right.
Goodness me. So. It's a lot about the echoes and the waves, so I imagine if you looked around this room, we can't see them, but there's just radio waves going everywhere on various frequencies. So it's making sense of that and isolating those frequencies and putting the package back together.
Yeah. And is interference coming from other people? So there was all those problems we had to overcome, and this made the solution quite complex. And a couple of, even later on, you know, people were saying, oh, that's too complex, it's going to be too big an integrated circuit, it's going to be too power hungry, you know, it's just not feasible. Mm. And that's why, well, it was a good example, that's why we built it. We had to build our chip to convince people that it would work, and that's one of the later chips we built. And later on there's a photo of John and me holding up the first, basically, product that came out of this work.
Yeah. What was that moment when you were able to go, okay, you know, we've prototyped it, we can take this now and run with it? Was there a signal that inspired you to go, okay, we're set to go to sell this?
Yeah, I think there was with this box just came up. We were wheeling it around, and you know, we tried a large number of different parameters. The advantage of that first prototype is we could make it do anything. You could control all the different parameters, hundreds of different combinations, and we found one that worked. That gave us the sense to go on and go around the world saying to people. But it wasn't until we actually built one that was reasonable size and we had them sitting in the lab, and no matter what we did, it kept giving zero errors. That was the moment. That was in 1997 that we had that going, and we knew that it works, we can prove it, you can do anything, it's going to work.
Zero errors.
0.00.
Nice one.
Yeah, I must say, from my perspective, though, I remember a series of sort of eureka moments as you would see the answer to, as the team, we would see the answer to some part of the problem, and you think, wow, we've got something here. And then you go to a prototype. And then there were further important things for me. There was a company. Terry was one of the co-founders. a company started by Neil Westy and Terry and David Skellen, who are collaborating with us, a company that was Radiata. And the that company demonstrated the first chips. You know, these are chips this size that...
they'll come up soon.
Those chips were demonstrated at NetWorld plus Interop in Atlanta the week before the Sydney Olympics.
Ah.
And that they were the first chips to meet the new Wi-Fi standard.
Right. So Wi-Fi, did you guys come up with the term Wi-Fi? Was that a...
No, we engineers came up with the 802.11a standard.
Cool.
Cool.
And
yeah.
The marketing folk took one look at that and said, that will never fly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, it's never going to fly. It is... I've been working on a project here at the museum with these robots that we send around, and we give virtual tours of the museum. And as a part of that project, we had to upgrade the Wi-Fi, and I had to get deep into it. But those sort of numbers and that terminology really does spin my head. It's not really my thing. And I suspect a lot of people in the audience and our wider audience perhaps get lost in some of the technicalities of it, but it doesn't matter because we just have to hit connect to the local hotspot. That's all we need.
We're standing on the shoulders of lots.
Yes.
Lots of people have put together complex standards and all. Yeah, it's incredible how much complexity is hidden from us all now.
Yeah. And so just speaking of complexity, you then moved in, I'm sure there were other stages, but you then moved into this titanic battle with the technology companies around the world, and CSIRO launched a test legal case against one company, and then everyone just countersued you at the same time. Do you want to give some reflections on that time? Because you'd done the research and the work, and then now suddenly this thing landed on you. That must have been a bit overwhelming.
Yeah, I think we need to just backtrack and point out we did lodge a provisional patent in 1992, and then we lodged a final patent specification in 1993, mm-hmm. Saying this is, if you want to build a high-speed wireless local area network, this is the way to do it. Detailed drawings, the works, full masses of legal phraseology about modulation means and plurality of devices, all those terms lawyers love.
Yep.
And this patent was granted in the US in January 23rd, 1995. Mm-hmm. And then sort of, you know, that was fine. And in the, as John said, in 2000, the Radiata showed chipsets that met the new standard that the IEEE had just agreed to with a lot of input from us that this was the way to do it. And then people started to ship products. Hmm. And we had a patent that was on those products.
So once your technology was in the IEEE standards, that's when it just started being used without payment.
Yeah, and I might add that, you know, before the IEEE issued that standard, they look through patents, and they we informed them we had a patent, and we explained it to them. And on their website, they say, you know, there's a section, this standard, these are the patents we know about which you may or may not mm-hmm. choose to go and license. And, you know, our patent was the only one at that time based on that standard. So we felt, you know, we told the world about the patent and no one was paying us royalties. Mm. So time to do something about it.
Yeah. But you wouldn't have known what you were letting yourself in for.
No, I don't think.
Do you want to take us through that?
It was kind of, you know, I was a naive engineer. I thought you'd go knock on the door, here's a 20-page patent, your product's doing it, you know, let's negotiate. Mm-hmm. And basically you get, you're from Australia, you didn't get a response.
Yeah, I think the CSIRO board had some... You know, they are to be congratulated for for hanging in there, because it's been a long process, and Terry's been involved in it right through.
Yeah. It started in 2003 with trips around America. No, I didn't do this. With CSIRO legal people going around, visiting the companies, engaging lawyers, starting writing letters. And then it went to trial with one company. The first a company picked itself, basically. It refused to just even negotiate. All the other companies do the stalling tactics. And so we took them to court, and it went through the court process. There was a judgment made, which they appealed. And then suddenly, as you know, eight large companies, and large we mean the big boys,
Apple, IBM,
Intel, Microsoft, countersued the CSIRO. And so suddenly they put a lawsuit on the CSIRO in California, because our original case was done in Texas and California, because they like doing things in California, and they wanted to sue us and prove our patent invalid. We again went to court in California and said, well, we've already done a case in Texas, so it should all go to Texas, which it did. And then suddenly we ended up in the mother of all lawsuits in Texas, with nine companies being sued by CSIRO. But all the inventors, John, myself, John Dean, Graham Daniels, Diet Ostry, and a number of other people were deposed by their lawyers. We went over to the US several times and sat down in a room for days while they grilled us with questions. They sent some of the lawyers out here to grill other people. And then it ended up finally, after delays, and if anyone's going to pay you $50 million, they don't want to pay it tomorrow. Pay it next year or the year after, they'll delay it. But we ended up in court, and we ended up, various shenanigans went on, and they ended up paying before the final verdict came through. They all paid
up. So they caved.
They all caved, yeah. During the court case, it was quite funny. On the first day in the court case, there were 10 lawyers there. The next day in the court case, there were 8, because two of them had already paid up and gone home. And
I think technically it's called a settlement.
A settlement, yes. An agreement was reached.
Gentleman's agreement.
Yes.
You may not be able to say, but which was the last company standing?
Well, there is still an outstanding case going on with Cisco, which is an argument about... It turned, after a lot of shenanigans, they tried to prove the patent was invalid. It was obvious. They tried to prove that what's called inequitable conduct by me and, to a lesser extent, John, that we had deliberately deceived the patent office in getting the patent. We withheld important information. That fell over. They got the patent re-examined twice. It's just kept going on. But in the end, all the cases ended up being just about damages, how much money they would actually pay, what the percentage was. And again, it's not just the royalty figure, but there's also a damages because they didn't pay.
Yeah.
And there's one case that's going to be finalised in May next year in Texas.
And then you can draw a line under that.
Yeah.
Wow. So we've got rivers of gold coming into the Australian taxpayers' account from this blue sky research and this pure research, this radio telescope, radio astronomy background that you both come from. I mean, that's an interesting observation that, these days you very much funding and... From everyone is often decided purely on the basis of something that's going to deliver an immediate return. Do you have observations on how science funding or technology funding from the public purse is handled?
Well, I'm certainly a great believer of you need a variety of approaches. Blue sky on research on its own, I don't think we'll get you there, but a mix of blue sky and more outcome-oriented research is appropriate. But I think we benefited from, as much as anything, from the people who'd, as I said before, who'd cut their teeth on some of the difficult problems in blue sky research and other research.
Yeah.
And it's the training of the people, probably, that's one of the important things. But the other comment is, if you go ahead to do something, whether it's a small startup, technology startup company, or a big research project, in my experience has been you can only plan so far, and a short way down the track, you're going to get blindsided by something you didn't see, and you'll probably change direction.
Yeah.
And I think you need to preserve the flexibility to change direction.
Yeah.
And don't give up quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of nonsense talked at the moment about fast failure. A lot of people tried to fast fail this project.
Right.
And, you know, I even had one unforgettable conversation with a bureaucrat who said, oh, look, you know, yeah, there's no point. We'll just back down and let the rest of the world catch up and then we'll see where we're going. And I'm saying, just you don't do that.
Let the world catch up.
You don't let the world catch up. You don't slow down. If you're ahead, you go faster. But it's... And look, there's my favourite... Australians love sporting analogies. So the question for the room is, who knows who Louise Graham is? Ever heard of her? Well, you all watched her for 45 seconds in September 2000 chasing a lovely Australian lady in a green suit. She came second in the 400 metres.
Ah.
There's no prizes for coming second in the technology and the research game.
Yeah.
If you're ahead, go for it.
You said before about standing on the shoulders of giants, which I think is a Newton quote. Mm-hmm. And you both come from a radio astronomy background, and I've worked in science communication since I joined the Department of Science in 87, and it's always amazed me how perhaps unappreciated the radio astronomy community and achievements of Australian scientists has been over that time. I don't think people really understand just how high regard radio astronomy from Australia is held around the world. Do you see that?
Australia has been one of the small number of pioneers, global pioneers in radio astronomy. It came out of, for the large part, came out of radar.
Mm.
In the Second World War, but Australia, under some inspired leadership from people like Pawsey, have blazed a trail. We've done many of it, been right at the forefront in some of the major innovations with things like aperture synthesis, interferometry. We've got quite iconic telescopes like the Dish.
Yeah.
And we've, I think on a per capita basis, we've punched well above our weight.
Mm-hmm. Did you like the portrayal of Australian radio astronomers in The Dish? Cardigans and pipes.
I found it a bit unfortunate that the Sam Neill character was playing John Bolton, who... I'm told was one seriously smart guy.
Yeah.
And the Sam Neill character, as these things do, tended to play him as a bit of a...
It's a bit of a bumbler, yeah.
Yeah,
bumbler.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Well,
story well told.
It's very Australian guy.
Yeah.
We'll go to questions from the audience in a moment, so if people want to have a little think about what they might like to ask... John and Terry. While you do that, I just a little anecdote. I was in London last year and I was driving the children of some friends to go and visit the Science Museum, and Archie, who was about 12, was sitting in the back seat, and he was, you know, very keen to get there to see the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, which powered the Spitfire and the Lancaster and other airplanes, and he was rattling off British innovations, and he went, essentially said, what has Australia ever invented? And of course I thought, Hills hoist, stump jump plough, he's not going to be very impressive. Said, oh, well, Wi-Fi. And so that sort of shut up the comments from the back seat. And I was just wondering, you know, what you think about people like me and probably many Australians taking this joy, you know, and taking a bit of reflected glory and pleasure from the fact that that we invented Wi-Fi. Because you must feel proud of that achievement, I imagine.
Yeah, I think it's an important thing, and it put, particularly the patent suit, put Australia back on the map in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, oh, they're taking us seriously, and a lot of, you know, US companies are now getting Australian technology, buying licenses from the technology from organisations like NICTA, where I was working, and CSIRO licensing. It became a lot easier, and I think it's interesting to note there are uncovered stories out there. There is, you know, Google Maps is another technology that was invented in Australia.
Really?
You know, yeah, people don't realise that.
It was, oh, I've got another thing to say. Good.
The Rasmussen brothers had a little company down in Pyrmont in Sydney. They were doing mapping technology, and Google liked it so much they came and bought it.
There you go.
So, and that, you know, Google Maps is now developed in Sydney still. Wow. They built the team up around that. And so there's another example of an Australian invention we all use.
Yes.
All the time.
All the time. And we were unaware.
There's a lot of Australians in key positions in Silicon Valley and places like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the Rolls-Royce Merlin. I think very often innovation is driven by needs.
Yes.
And we look at some of the Australian innovations, and there are plenty of them.
Mm.
They're often driven by needs. In mining, we're a global top gun in terms of the technologies used and developed.
Well, CSIRO Data 61, which is the autonomous systems lab, essentially merged with NICTA, has many mining applications and has commercialised these things, 3D mapping of underground mine passages and those sort of things. So
And big data is one of the things that is coming.
Yeah.
Well, it's here in many ways.
Sorry, we'll just open up to some questions now. Penny and Janae are going to walk up and down with some microphones. I will ask you to wait until you get the microphone before you ask your question. I'll tell you why once we pick our first question. Does anyone have a question in our audience here? We've got a question down in the second row here. The main reason is for our streamed audience, they won't be able to hear the question unless you speak into the microphone. Yeah.
Very well done there, everybody. Can you possibly explain, I might be getting this wrong, the concept of its packet arrangement, isn't it, in the transmission? It's a before and after coding somehow, so it keeps everything in the right order. I'm not that familiar with it, but it's got a defined beginning and end of certain parts of the transmission, so it doesn't get mixed up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, getting technical, I guess some of the drawings up here. Basically, you have to have a header at the beginning of a packet, and a sort of end of packet identifier. And the packets have to be of certain lengths. You can send short packets or long packets. Depending on the type of transmission. Like if you're sending a video, then you send long packets because it's lots of information, whereas other things you'd send shorter packets. That's the at the packet level, when you're packetizing the data, you've got to send it in packets because people move around the room, and again, as people are moving around the room, the characteristics change. So again, you can't just stream it. You've got to effectively resynchronize it, restart it all the time. That was one of the parts of our invention. And within the packet, we also do what's called interleaving or shuffling the bits around so that the error correction works better.
Another question right down the front here, Janae.
Thanks. I was wondering what the royalty monies and the damages, what purpose they were put to. Were they put back into science?
About $200 million was used to set up an endowment fund, And that endowment fund is being used to fund research and researchers around Australia, particularly young researchers. So that was particularly gratifying to see that this is hopefully priming the pumps for the next Wi-Fi. Beyond that, the royalties went back into revenue.
Janae.
From the live stream.
Yep.
Elaine Bean from Adelaide City Council would just like to ask, at what point would you consider yourself satisfied, able to sit on your laurels? Where do you think Wi-Fi will reach its peak?
Well, you should never sit on your laurels, but I guess time has caught up with both of John and I, who are no longer in full-time employment, so we've drawn a line at that level. Wi-Fi reach its peak. It's still getting faster and faster. There's different applications, particularly with video, high-definition video, the 4K video streams that I should be talking to Adelaide,
yes.
Sorry.
Yes. hi, Adelaide.
there's another aspect too, I think. A technology becomes truly successful when you're no longer aware of it.
Adelaide.
Becomes truly successful when you're no longer aware of it. So the plumbing and so forth, we are aware of it at some level, but we don't spend our time worrying about it. I think Wi-Fi has probably got to that stage, and if anything, it's moving towards. It has moved towards the sorts of applications that we're using on our devices. And I personally think the thing that's sneaking up on us is that these devices have in recent years become quite intelligent, much, much more intelligent than we thought of artificial intelligence, and things like voice recognition is becoming almost as good as humans, and lots of other areas. Things are being done that, frankly, I couldn't do.
Well, we've got newspapers replacing journalists with programs that write our articles, and it's very hard to distinguish between a journalist-written sports report and a robot-issued one. We've got a question up.
We can have bots generating fake news now.
Yeah, they're generating a lot of fake news.
Absolutely. Okay, we've got a question there.
During the course of your discussion, you mentioned 4G and 5G, which I've always thought of as being wide-area telephone communications, and we're talking about Wi-Fi, which is something I use in my home. What's the connection between the two, please?
What I was saying is the technology that we developed for Wi-Fi, the methodology, the radio communication systems, are now being applied to the wider telecommunications. So that technology has now sort of permeated into other areas. So the sort of techniques that were used on 2G and 3G couldn't be scaled up to go fast enough for 4G and 5G, and they've come across with the technology that's used in Wi-Fi.
Okay, thank you. And we've got another question, and then we'll come down to this question here.
So just following up from the previous two questions, I think I'm curious as to, has Wi-Fi gone open source, or does someone own Wi-Fi still and is driving the technology forward, or sort of is it out in the world and everybody gets to develop it from here?
Well, the standards are, you've got to have standards to have interoperability, because your Samsung phone can talk to your Netgear router and your all the. So those standards are put out by the IEEE, which is the Institute of Electronic and Electrical Engineers, based in the US. So they issue the standards. There's a standards, working groups working on making it go better and faster. So the standards are published. Anyone can build something to those standards, but there's a number of patents covering those standards now. Our patent has expired. That's the other thing that people don't realise. The patent has a 17-year lifetime. Our patent expired in 2013. So Wi-Fi as itself is, you know, the standard is there. Anyone can build equipment to that standard, but there are other patents out there that people do pay royalties on.
Those standards, by the way, have tended to be ongoing work, so new standards are being developed that presuppose the existence of existing standards, and in some sense that is open source, in that anybody can participate in those standards, standards making bodies, but it's difficult to get your own way if there are many others.
Must make it an interesting choice to as to when you lodge your patent. You want to get it in before anyone else gets ownership of that idea, but you don't want to get it in so early that you're 17 years, seemingly a random amount of time, expires before you've got time to commercialise it properly.
Yeah, I think the answer is get it in as soon as possible.
Right.
Yeah, I think it'd be a brave person to delay.
Lock it down.
Lock
okay.
it down.
Oh, we've got a question.
Then
second
round.
There's one up the back.
Okay.
Hi. Do you ever think that Wi-Fi will make something like the NBN obsolete?
No. Simple answer, no. Optical fibre will always go a lot faster. And there's... someone once put it, God isn't making any more radio spectrum. It's already crowded. It is really, really crowded out there. That's part of the work. You've got to make it as fast as possible. You need the backbones. The backbones running up, you'd be amazed what the capacity, the hundreds of gigabits on the backbones of the fibres going between the capital cities, going around your streets even. It's the amount of traffic on the internet is huge.
One of the beauties of Wi-Fi, the original idea was keep it small, so you have a Wi-Fi access point or whatever you like to call it, and it only covers a small area like this lecture theatre, and that way you only use the spectrum, the radio waves in this area, and somebody else is free to use it in the next building.
I think we've got time for one more question up the back there. Yes.
This Wi-Fi kicked off with a very clear goal of generating 100 megabits per second communication. So if you had your time over again, could you come up with some other projects you think would be similarly clearly stated that we'll be discussing in 30 years' time?
Well, it's... It's an interesting question. It's always tricky. I think the some of the things that would be of interest to me are more, again, the applications building on these technologies. Telehealth is my big passion. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of work in telehealth over the years, basically providing remote diagnosis to people. That's a goal we set ourselves. We developed the technology. It hasn't been taken up particularly well. I think the 100 megabits was a nice, clear number, and that helped a lot.
Yeah, I usually answer a question, what do you think's coming next, with ask somebody younger than 14.
Snapchat them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or a sci-fi writer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, what do you think of the internet? You know, like it's this. This was a question someone asked me to sort of put in here. You can see these two sides of the internet, where it's a dark and dangerous place full of extremist groups and terrorists and fake news, like you said before. Or is it this? You know, this thing that makes the world smaller, brings us all together, and makes us all more connected and productive and happy and nice. Did you have a reflection on that?
Well, I guess my take is it's facilitated both the dark and the light sides of human nature, I'm afraid.
It reflects us.
I do watch with some horror what's happening with fake news and the way it's influenced some recent events. Mm. And you wonder whether the law has to catch up with some of these things. Should we be free to
some
to say things that would,
the nasty word regulation may be in some way.
On the other hand, we're already struggling under too many regulations.
How do you regulate the internet?
Yeah. Mm.
So we don't have flying cars yet. Well, maybe just one or two, but they're not commercially available. We don't have hoverboards that don't explode. So is there anything else you sort of see coming up? Because you would be talking with inventors and technologists all over the world, I suspect.
Yeah, I think that the one problem hasn't been cracked is the home networking control. Uh-huh. People talk about the Internet of Things and all the data that's being generated. I think a lot of that is overblown hype. I think the problem is technologists haven't come up with a way to make it invisible. I think John touched on this earlier. It has to be invisible. It can't be all this mishmash of things. A few years ago, I automated one of our display areas at our place of work, and I had two very smart engineers working on it for 3 months to get it working properly with the lights swapping and things changing as you went. And that's just crazy. So I think that's an area that's going to have to change. And I think the other area is education is very important with technology. There was a big push about 3 years ago for open universities and online courses. You could enrol at MIT or you could enrol at Stanford. And that's gone very quiet at the moment.
It has, hasn't it?
It's, but I don't know if it's going, but it's got to be the way of the future. But
I think the sense I have is a lot of young people are looking at online courseware and it's putting some big pressure on
the university.
Anybody but the number one universities, high-ranked ones, but it's getting the accreditation that's the... Anyway.
Yeah, but I think that using the internet for access to information...
Yes. Well, that would be great for global productivity, lifting people out of poverty. Education is obviously key, and education and health, so...
And Australia's dropping.
Mm. Yes.
Yes, more laptops with Wi-Fi in schools. That's my answer.
Now that the royalties have expired.
Yes.
I think we've sort of run out of time now, haven't we, Janae? Yes. Okay, well, it's been a great pleasure having a chat to you both and sharing your observations. An hour is obviously nowhere near enough to get into any detail, but it's been wonderful to hear your observations and your recollections. So please join me in thanking Dr. Terry Percival and Dr. John O'Sullivan for being here today. Thank you. So this was our last lecture in our History of the World in 100 Objects lecture series. Apparently, our podcast of the full series of these lectures will be available early next year, so watch out for that if you missed some of the earlier ones, which were fascinating guests and fascinating topic areas. So those podcasts available early next year. Exhibition closes at the end of January next year, so get your skates on and to the exhibition if you haven't seen it. I'd like to thank our audience here today for your questions and interest in the subject, and to our remote audiences in Kiama Library and Adelaide City Library. Thank you for joining us today, and to our wider internet audience. Thank you very much, everyone, and enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.